This week on Life and Faith.
The guy I did my PhD on, Friedrich von Hugel, there's one quote I really love. He says, "Wise living requires frequent refusals." It's quite countercultural because we have this sense that we've got to always say yes to every opportunity. And, you know, he got to a point of working out how much he could try to help others without getting markedly empty.
We have entered into an amusing ourselves to death moment in history.
It doesn't make sense to me. If there is God, God's supposed to be free.
I was 100% sure that I was sacrificing on the altar of truth my only chance for happiness in this world.
Miracles don't necessarily change anybody's mind. They just get their attention.
And so I had to run with my child on my back, the ISA army coming behind us.
I said, "Gee, Uncle George, this is luxurious for a communist." Son, he said, "Nothing's too good for the worker. Nothing."
Welcome to Life and Faith from CPX. I'm Simon Smart, and I'm a recovering extrovert.
And I'm Natasha Moore, and I am a massive introvert, though I have spent significant chunks of my life masquerading as an extrovert.
Yeah, there are a few things humans like talking about more than themselves. So today, we're bringing you an episode on the endlessly popular topic of introversion and extroversion. It's a staple of all those personality tests, the Myers-Briggs type indicator, Enneagram, all that sort of stuff. And we're aware today that we're sort of wading into dangerous territory. People have strong opinions about these things.
Yeah. From my extensive online research for this episode, it does feel like every time someone says, okay, here's what it actually means to be introverted or extroverted, someone else is always there to say, actually, that's not really what it's about. You've kind of misunderstood. Personality science is contested territory. I mean, even the spelling is contested, right? It's extroverted or it's extraverted with an A. The whole thing is a minefield.
I hadn't even sort of factored that into the dangers of this episode. But my understanding is that it means something like the sort of person that's an extrovert gains energy from being with lots of other people, as opposed to what I used to think it meant.
Which was
just sort of loud and
outgoing and introverts are shy,
that sort of stuff.
Yeah. So I think everything's an oversimplification, I suppose, but the accepted definition or rule of thumb way of judging what you are is, do you get your energy more from being around other people? Do you recharge by being on your own? You need a lot of internal processing time. So there is a lot of, you know, disagreement about this, but one of the reasons the distinction is so popular is that lots of people do find that it has explanatory power, that it helps us to understand ourselves. Why am I like this? Why do I prefer this? And especially helps us to understand the people who aren't the same as us.
One of the main differences between introverts and extroverts is that extroverts get their energy from hanging out with other people, whereas introverts aren't mentally ill. Now, if you're looking to get an introvert, you can either adopt a baby one, known as a shylet, or rescue an adult from an introvert shelter, generally referred to as a library. On arriving home, show your new introvert the location of the litter tray, the feeding bowl, and any windows it can jump out of in case the doorbell rings. A pair of introverts is called an awkward, a group of introverts is called an angst. They are generally never found together in the wild, except by accident, in which case they will apologise for making eye contact, nod politely, then run screaming in opposite directions.
Contrary to... Well, these days you can't get far online without bumping into yet another explanation, whether it's serious or less so, of how to care for your introvert, which is the title of that YouTube video. But that's a relatively recent development. People weren't talking about this nearly as much, say, 20 years ago.
Yeah, there's been a big cultural shift in this. You could call it the Quiet Revolution, yeah, which is also the name of an organization founded by a woman called Susan Cain. The Quiet Revolution really wants to champion introverts being themselves and contributing to the world around them as introverts instead of being kind of forced to fit into the patterns and ways of working that are natural to extroverts. So Susan Cain is a writer and an introvert, surprise, surprise, who gave one of the most watched TED Talks ever. It's from back in 2012, and it's called The Power of Introverts.
All the times that I got the message that somehow my quiet and introverted style of being was not necessarily the right way to go, and that I should be trying to pass as more of an extrovert. And I always sensed deep down that this was wrong and that introverts were pretty excellent just as they were. But for years, I denied this intuition. And so I became a Wall Street lawyer, of all things, instead of the writer that I had always longed to be, partly because I needed to prove to myself that I could be bold and assertive too. And I was always going off to crowded bars when I really would have preferred to just have a nice dinner with friends. And I made these self-negating choices so reflexively that I wasn't even aware that I was making them. Now, this is what many introverts do, and it's our loss for sure, but it is also our colleagues' loss and our community's loss. And at the risk of sounding grandiose, it is the world's loss, because when it comes to creativity and to leadership, we need introverts doing what they do best. A third to a half of the population are introverts. A third to a half. So that's one out of every two or three people you know.
That's from Susan Cain's TED Talk, The Power of Introverts. It's worth going and watching the whole thing. It's full of fascinating detail, including a cultural history of how extroversion kind of became the default cultural norm across the 20th century, how introverts became almost suspect. She makes a compelling case for why introverts should be valued for what they are and what they bring to the table as introverts.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Are the introverts rising up against the rest
very
of us?
Very quietly.
You could say her quiet revolution has been pretty successful. It seems a lot more accepted and talked about now that being introverted is not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, it could be a good thing.
Yeah. And I mean, in some ways, I wonder if it's almost been too successful. It's almost gone from, you know, introverts need to try harder to fit in and be socially agreeable to introverts are actually the intelligent, sensitive, deep ones, and maybe extroverts are really a bit shallow. You know, I don't know if you've ever seen that fridge magnet or whatever that says, if you don't enjoy your own company, maybe you bore other people too.
Like, no, I haven't. That's a good one though.
I think extroverts kind of get a bad rap now, almost. It's swung the other way. So I do think it's wonderful to have a framework for understanding in our relationships or in work settings, why people function differently and what they need to flourish. But some of this does get to a point of like, okay, extroverts, here's how to look after your introvert. You know, don't be offended if they don't want to talk to you, and don't make them engage in small talk. Like, that's trauma for them, and no sudden noises. And, you know, I kind of get a little bit like, yeah, God forbid an introvert would actually have to make an effort to be nice to someone socially when they don't feel like it, you know. And I say that as a big introvert.
Well, I'm well aware you're an introvert. You identify with Susan Cain's story of spending a lot of her life pretending to be an extrovert.
Yeah, because I was very quiet and, you know, bookish as a child, and definitely an introvert and like to spend time on my own. But I think I can actually trace this back to my reading of Enid Blyton novels. Oh. A lot of people will be familiar with, you know, Magic Faraway Tree and Secret Seven, yes, and stuff. But she has these boarding school books, these girls' boarding schools. And these books really instilled in me this lesson, I think, that what you wanted to be was the outgoing, bubbly, vivacious girl. Like, that was the thing to be.
Right.
And the quiet girls were, you know, a bit less interesting, maybe a bit suspect. And it wasn't until kind of my mid-20s and people were kind of talking more about introversion, and I was like, wait, that's me, and that's okay. I can
that
be that.
Yeah, yeah, good. Yeah,
what's your story?
Yeah, I think I've always been an extrovert in that definition we've decided upon is the right one. In that gaining energy from being with other people. I've always been like that. I've always loved being with lots of other people.
And of course, this has all been hyper relevant lately with the coronavirus lockdown.
Yeah.
I mean, from one perspective, this has all been one big accidental psychological social, yes, experiment. How did you cope as a sort of extrovert in lockdown?
Pretty well, actually. Mm. I was still able to get out with my mates and go surfing. So I could catch up with people, do the exercise.
Bit of an outlet.
So I need the outlet and a bit more reflective time, reading time. But I also thought it's going to end eventually. So you feel like, oh, I can get through this, and then we'll be back to crowds and stuff, parties and whatever. Not that I go to that many parties, I have to say.
Been really missing that part of your
night clubbing, not so much. And how about you? I think you've coped okay, haven't you, in this period?
Yeah, I think apart from a few kind of hiccups along the way, I think I was really one of those I've been training for this my whole life kind of people. I did just fine. Certainly my impression online from what people were posting was that there was a lot of kind of self-discovery going on.
Yeah, I thought I might and I didn't discover my hidden chef. And much to the disappointment of my family, I didn't really. But people were finding they were maybe less extroverted or introverted than they previously thought.
Yeah, and I guess under more intense circumstances, it does sort of test what you think you're like. It pushes your limits. So I thought I'd ask around and see if I could persuade a few people to share some of their experiences of introversion or extroversion during lockdown. And I got a lot of responses.
My name's Luke Clifton and I'm a born extrovert. So when COVID came along and we were forced to work from home, I was literally climbing the walls. For the first 6 weeks, I really missed everyone. I missed the social interaction. I missed the water cooler conversations. I felt like I was missing out. A deep sense of FOMO, even though I knew everybody else was working from home too.
Hi, I'm Claire, and I'm an extrovert, and I've really loved isolation. I think it's partly because I'm somebody who likes to be self-reliant, and isolation helps with that because you don't see everyone else, so you have to live in your own apartment, do your own work, motivate yourself.
I'm an introvert, and I actually found the isolation during lockdown completely fine. I loved that the pressure not to waste my weekend by staying home was gone as well. And I really enjoyed those long days at home.
I kept seeing Facebook posts saying things like, check on your extrovert friends, they're not coping. And I thought, gee, as an introvert, I'm not really coping either. I think it was missing things like my morning commute and going up the road for coffee, maybe at lunchtime, all of those things that I really value to have a bit of alone time during the day. I love my family and I love that I get to spend time with them, but it was a struggle. It was something I wasn't expecting.
Hey, I'm Joe. I'm what I call like an introvert with extroverted tendencies. I don't work your normal 9 to 5 hours. I'm a freelancer, my schedule is kind of all over the place. So I'm really used to spending a lot of time alone with not a whole lot of human contact. So when lockdown started, I found it really easy. So it was kind of a breeze. I was like, yep, sweet as, got this.
I think there's this other layer from my experience as well, where there was this emotional exhaustion of video calls that was a surprise too. And I've never wanted to miss catching up with people. Like I've always loved it. And so the experience of having catch-ups with people and feeling really emotionally exhausted at the end of that was new, you know, potentially is what might be the experience of an introvert more consistently. And so that was an interesting experience, whether or not that speculation's accurate. But feeling drained by catching up with people was surprising and in some ways disappointing and confusing.
As a reader, so like one of my favourite novels is Jane Eyre, and this quote from Jane Eyre really speaks to me and how I've experienced this. It says, "There is no happiness like that of being loved by your fellow creatures and feeling that your presence is an addition to their comfort." And I really connect to that because connection is so key to how I feel well in the world and like I matter and like I have a place. And without physical proximity, there just isn't that kind of connection.
So looking back on this unusual period and looking forward as well, people have been finding some things out about themselves.
It's been actually a blessing in disguise. It's something now that I know that I can do. I can focus if I put my mind to it. It seems like an obvious thing to say, but when you're an extrovert and you know, fly by the seat of your pants, it's not one of the tools that you pull out of your kit bag very often. So I'm actually learning from the experience. I can't say I deeply enjoy it. I am looking forward to getting back to work, but it hasn't been a complete disaster like initially I thought it was going to be in the first 6 weeks.
Ultimately, though, after the initial 8 weeks of lockdown, I discovered that I could manage. I still love the sound and I'm definitely more proactive and I function better with it. And small things like being able to hear people outside again when I open my windows or sit on my balcony just make my heart happy. So I learned more about, I guess, my extroversion, and it's not about direct social connection. It's more the implication of that sound, knowing that people are around, you're not alone, and therefore you are okay.
So I loved the slower pace. I loved being at home with the family, not having to rush about. But at the same time, I found myself just really feeling like I needed to be alone, not just alone in my house with my family, which I discovered when I realized a few weeks in that I'd retreated to my bed for a few days, only getting up and checking on the kids when they needed to. So it was definitely an interesting experience that I would probably like to do for 3 months out of six.
Life and Faith, and Natasha and I are talking about introversion and extroversion and what they might tell us about ourselves and how to lead our lives, really.
We've all become a lot more fluent with these terms, I think, over the last several years. It's now a really common way of talking about what we're like as individuals. But of course, the truths about being human that they're trying to capture are not new.
Now, one of the traditional ways of talking about this is the distinction between the contemplative and the active life. Now, these categories don't map onto each other precisely or neatly, but I suspect there's a bit of overlap here, right?
Yeah, and the active-contemplative distinction in particular made me think of someone that I met recently who I thought might have some light to shed on the introvert-extrovert thing. Her name is Robin Wrigley Carr, and she lectures in theology and spirituality at Alpha Crucis College in Sydney.
I'm basically looking at a bunch of fantastic Christian women from the cemetery. Well, one of them's alive. They tend to be women who've made a big difference in the public square in some significant way. And I'm particularly interested in their personal lives, their internal worlds, their letters, their private writings, that fueled how they made a difference out there in the world. So I'm sort of arguing that if you want to do something significant out there, it's who you are that, you know, it's your internal world that is the fuel that means the making the difference in the world is really significant. And not coming from a egotistical look at me position, but coming from a place of generosity.
Robin is a part-time fellow this year with an organisation called ADM, and she's digging into the lives of women like Sojourner Truth, who was born into slavery and became an abolitionist and women's rights advocate, and Josephine Butler, who fought against child prostitution, among other things, in 19th century England, and Edith Stein, who is a nun who was killed at Auschwitz. When I asked Robin about how these women's inner and outer lives fit together, she took me back 500 years to the life of the Carmelite nun, mystic, reformer, Teresa of Avila.
So she was 16th century Spanish, bit of a ratbag teenager. In fact, her father stuck her in an Augustinian convent at the age of 16 because he was scared she'd get pregnant. So she had lost her mother, who died at childbirth, and, you know, she's in this convent to kind of shut her up. And then eventually she decides to become a nun herself, but not because she wants to be a nun. It's because she doesn't want to die of childbirth. She doesn't want to get married. So, you know, she kind of was parading and, you know, being a bit of a fake nun for 20 years, then has this profound conversion. And from there on, has a lot of mystical experiences of prayer, but also realizes that the convent life had become quite worldly and had a lot of rich girls who just wanted to go somewhere nice, if you like. And so she was a reformer. She ended up reforming the whole Carmelite order and founding new convents. And she was a spiritual director to priests and even the King of Spain. She was kind of doing these amazing things on the public stage, but a lot of it was fueled from a life that was very prayerful. And I suppose the biggest thing that strikes me about Teresa is she's very spunky and feisty, but she's incredibly humble. So I think we only need to see in a lot of leadership today, a lot of it seems to be, look at me, you know, it's all about me and my reputation and safeguarding my reputation so I'm elected or whatever it is. And with someone like her, it's all about how she can make a difference in the world in terms of honouring God, being generous to others. It's not about herself. So I think the humble posture is massive for her, and that comes from the furnace of prayer. So one of the things she talks a lot about is self-knowledge, and it's quite different to what we might think of self-knowledge today. You know, we work out who we are by doing all these personality tests, and it's all about looking within. For her, her self-knowledge is really a double knowledge, and as she comes to know who God is, and that is through prayer. It's not just through shoving Bible verses in her head. It's in the furnace of prayer. As she comes to know who God is, she comes to see who she is in relation to God and how small she is because God is so huge. And so it's this self-knowledge is a deep humility. And I think just it means that she can do different stuff out there in the world because she's not getting in the way. She's not sitting looking at herself the whole time about, you know, how important am I? And for that reason, she's just a really profound model.
Maybe other things that looking at Teresa if you're an extrovert and looking at Teresa if you're an introvert, are there things that, you know, she has to teach you? I mean, not everyone's the same, right? And not everyone's going to live the same, act the same. We have to kind of live in keeping with our nature. So does she have different lessons for those two people?
This whole thing about introvert or extrovert, because I'm borderline. So I think what she might want to say to the extroverts is it's worth having some time away from the people. And in fact, that's probably a healthy thing in terms of enriching your life and deepening your life. Because sometimes when we're in the action all the time, there isn't enough reflective space. And it can feel like we're just on a conveyor belt of activity. And so there's never really the space to confront our soul or really assess whether this is the best way to be using our time. I think that she'd probably say that. And for the introverts, she might be wanting to encourage them to take some risks. So I don't want to put words into her mouth. Yeah, I mean, she's interesting because she's a 4 on the Enneagram, and so she's...
If you don't know what this means, don't worry, I don't either. Enneagram is another system of personality typing. Famous 4s apparently include Vincent van Gogh and Meryl Streep.
She's one of these, you know, artistic types who's a bit of a performer. And as she becomes more humble and secure in her identity, she then becomes a very effective 4 who can do anything on the world stage and isn't afraid. She's not afraid. She's courageous. But some of this courage comes from a very centered life. And I think she might be wanting to encourage the introverts to take a risk, whatever that looks like. And it doesn't have to be interacting with the King of Spain. I think sometimes we think bigger is better, and I don't agree with that. I really think people are making a difference in the world all the time in very small ways. But I suppose it would be to have some courage to reach out to love other people and care for other people in generous ways.
Talk to me about rest and solitude, like kind of practices that are very important, I think, to many, if not all, of the women you're looking at, and that are less central often, or common, or achievable, we feel, for our lives today.
The guy I did my PhD on, Friedrich von Hegel, there's one quote I really love. He says, "Wise living requires frequent refusals." And it's quite countercultural, because we have this sense that we've got to always say yes to every opportunity. And, you know, he got to a point of working out how much he could try to help others without getting markedly empty. And so he, you know, if someone asked him to do something, he would try to self-monitor where his energy levels were at. And then if he thought, it's too much, he would politely decline. And he was convinced that God would provide a helper with sufficient leisure for the purpose. And he'd just pray for the person. And I think there's some real wisdom in that, because most of our lives are just too full. They're too busy. They're too harried. And so this sense of being on a conveyor belt of activity means that we end up living a fairly shallow existence. And I think this rhythm of working 6 days and one day off that we see in the Hebrew Bible is a really, really powerful antidote to helping us actually be more rested and live a quality of life that is richer and deeper and less like survival mode. And that doesn't mean it's got to be 24 hours in the one day. I think for myself, going from Saturday dinner to Sunday dinner works for me, because I need Sunday night to get everything sorted for the next week. You know, by late Sunday afternoon, I'm thinking Monday, like, oh, heck, here we go again. But just interrupting all the busyness and the work feels really important. And I suppose, you know, it was really Eugene Peterson that taught me about this. He was a pastor, and he could feel that he was starting to burn out. And he realized if he didn't really take this seriously, he would burn out. And also, not only burn out, but start to think he was a bit important. And I think one of the things he really taught me was it's important to get out of the driver's seat for a day and just reflect upon what has happened in the last week and kind of regroup a bit. And also just have some fun, just kick back a bit, because the reality is if we work all the time, we lose our playfulness. We just become like a little bit pent up and a bit crackers. And I just think, you know, you even forget how to play and what it is that you really find life-giving.
A lot of these reflections hold good both for introverts and for extroverts. We all need rest. We all need solitude, even those of us who don't naturally take to it. The personality tests and the self-analysis can be a lot of fun. It's generally designed to be purposeful, though, to reveal something about not just what we enjoy or don't, but how we can most effectively contribute to the world around us.
I think each of these women eventually found a vocation. And that's a word that's never really made much sense to me, but I think I'm starting to get a little bit of an inkling of what it is. So for each of these women, it was a journey, and it's not like they worked it out early. It came often through quite a bit of suffering and then having something that really welled in their heart and soul as where they wanted to make a difference. I think sometimes people are too impatient about trying to work out what it is they're made to be. And I think it's a slow evolving. But I do think with each of these women, you know, they're contemplatives who then choose to make a difference in the world based on something that is put on their heart in some way. And it's unique for each one. So, you know, I think diversity and uniqueness of response is huge here, because there's no one way to live an effective life. And each of us works out how to do it from being in the nitty-gritty of life and through engaging in suffering and hard stuff.
Those who shared with me about their ISO experience clearly found the COVID crisis a bit of a catalyst for figuring out some stuff about themselves and their life. Robin's work on the inner lives of these very productive women of the past backs up that pattern.
I think when we're busy all the time, we don't really know what's going on, to be completely honest. So we lose a sense of who we are. We lose a sense of what's going on in the close relationships around us. And we're not very attentive. We're not very attentive to our own bodies and how we're becoming exhausted and stretched. The more exhausted we get, the less attentive we are to other people around us, you know, our families, our flatmates, our close friends. And I think we become less attentive to the big picture of what life's about because we become very focused in on survival. So, you know, it's when people have big crises in their lives that they often stop. They've got no choice. And interestingly, sometimes there's silence, you know, there's just, they've heard the tragic news and they stop and there's no words. And that can actually wake us up and make us more attentive and ask the big questions about what this is all about.
This has been Life and Faith with me, Simon Smart, and Natasha Moore. Thanks to Robin Wrigley-Carr, who introduced us to Teresa of Avila and other effective introverts of the past.
And thank you to the many people who put their hands up to share what lockdown was like for them as an extrovert or an introvert, especially to those introverts who had to overcome a little bit of reluctance. I see you.
Yes, thanks to them. Thanks to our producer, Anthea Godsmark, too, who's a bit to do to pull this episode together. We're taking a break at Life and Faith for a couple of weeks. We'll be back with new episodes on the 23rd of July. In the meantime, why don't you check out any episodes you've missed? We've had some really good ones lately.
And if you have feedback for us, either on this episode, I'm sure you'll have lots of opinions, or on any of our others, you can email us at podcast@publicchristianity.org. We would love to hear from you.
See you next time.